Striving for mediocrity in a world of excellence. This is the Chaser Report.
Hello and welcome to another afternoon edition of the Chaser Report. We have a full house here. Four microphones and four people. We have Gabby Bolt.
Hello.
Alex Avulovich.
Hi.
I'm Dom Knight. And the wonderful Rebecca Day Namuno.
Woo! I'm Rebecca Day Namuno. I feel like that's how I have to introduce myself all the time.
And you're in the Chaser newsroom.
I am. This is a bit exciting.
She's, getting to talk for more than 2 minutes, which she does every single day, every single podcast.
And more when I'm in social situations.
We've been doing a whole bunch of interviews with wonderful comedy people, and it's time for Beck to get behind the mic. And particularly, I'm keen to hear what you and Gabby have to say to each other about comedy and music coming together, because that's what both of you do. So Alex and I will just sit back and let the sparks fly. But also, the other thing on the agenda is, we made Gabby watch all of uni recently.
Oh, I just I just literally shuddered.
Can I say, I loved your work in that, by the way.
Thank
you. It was incredible.
My terrible haircut and clothes.
If you didn't hear that, so uni was a documentary that was made about Charles Firth, Andrew Hansen and some other people. Back in the late 90s, they were two of the three main focuses. Mm. Yes, but Beck was in the room for almost all of those incredibly cringe-inducing scenes. I wasn't. I knew everyone, but I wasn't. I stayed away from the whole thing.
Yeah, you were smart, Dom.
I'm in like one scene talking with Chaz, which was, deliberate.
Yeah.
And Beck was there for the... So should we start there or we start
with... Well, I have questions.
You have questions.
Okay, Charles isn't here, so it's kind of great because there is the scene that sticks out when I immediately think of it. Like, and I want to reiterate for anybody listening, I don't have notes in front of me about this. I literally just remember this.
Just flashbacks.
There is a scene where you're doing the comedy review.
Yes,
the arts review. And Charles, in his very director fashion, walks into the girls' change room backstage and he's like, "Now, look, the audience, it takes a little time to warm up, I don't really know what's going wrong." And I think it's either you or one of your friends is like, "Yeah, okay, like that's what it is." We're not acknowledging the fact that it's actually just that people didn't want to laugh at women in the 90s.
Well, nothing much has changed in the year 2021.
And Charles is just like, "I don't know what's really going on. I think it's just taking them a little bit longer." And then you just have this look on your face that's like, okay, Charles.
Yeah, it was our intermission pep talk, which is really usually it's reserved for football or for, sporting event. You don't have the coach you have the coach come in, but you don't have the director of the show come in halfway through and give you notes about how he thinks the audience are reacting to your work.
More energy. I just need some more energy.
As someone who saw that show, and I want to be kind in hindsight. What was it, 23 years ago or something?
Oh, my God.
No, more. 25 years ago.
It was 96.
25 years ago. I love that Charles never for a moment doubted that it might be the material.
That's exactly right. It was our delivery of said material.
You weren't getting the vision.
That's right. No, but it was a really interesting, because Gabby, after I heard you speak about it on the podcast, I went, I've got to watch it.
Yeah.
And it's been years since I've seen it. I think I probably watched it about 15 years ago maybe.
Wow.
And I watched it again and it is, oh my goodness. And things that back then I didn't even think about that were being filmed of our day-to-day uni life, I became quite nostalgic and quite sort of emotional at certain things, because in hindsight you look at it and go, oh, there's Craig as the stressed stage manager and it's good that he got in front of the camera because he was terrible as a stage manager. I've never seen a stage manager lose his cool so readily.
Look very upset for the majority of that episode.
He was very stressed. And
in the early days of the Chaser newspaper, Craig's job was to organise distribution. Which was like, as in work out the news agents and have the whole spreadsheet and all that kind of stuff.
How'd that go?
Not a core skill of Craig's.
No.
But going in front of the camera and being spontaneously funny turned out to be really good.
Amazing. I'm so glad he did that and made the transition. But I can only imagine the changes he would have had to put up with as the stage manager.
Yes.
I'm sure he would have been throwing things probably after Charles gave us that pep talk. He probably changed all the cues for act two. Who knows? But very interesting stuff. And just to look at all the people in the room. And I thought about it too. And I mentioned this to you, Gabby, that I thought it would be really lovely for someone to do a documentary on where everyone from that review in particular are now.
Because Simon Tajay still around?
Well, maybe we should make him a call.
I keep saying you should call him.
And just say, you know, because people have gone on to do, you know, Adam Spencer was in the room as a writer and Sarah Kendall and Tom Gleason.
Yeah, it was a massive,
you know, there was a lot of people around.
So many successful people went to uni with you.
Yeah, and they focused on Charles.
I know, what a miss.
Oh, I think, but I do recall, this is my little bit of gossip. I do recall Simon saying to me at one point, oh, Rebecca, he said, we had a debate about you. And I said, oh, who won? what the topic was, but it was about including certain stuff of me, like, and I was so thankful that that didn't happen, because uni's where you're meant to just try and fail, and you embrace the failure and you learn from it and you go, wow, like I got up and played theatre sports for the first time and was terrible, but I quickly learned how to play, you know, that kind of thing, and to have that captured, I have to say, they're brave people for allowing it to go ahead.
Not brave, completely lacking in self-awareness. And that's the hilarious thing about uni, is to have all that cockiness and insecurity that people in their, you know, early 20s or late teens have. Hello, interns. But just the total lack of any, but saying things which would, like any, I'm sure all of you would realise would come over as terrible. And Charles was just like, go into it. Oh, yeah, don't worry about it. My dad actually knows some of these.
Oh, activities. Yeah, he was really like wearing his whole personality on his sleeve, to be honest. I was amazed.
And that's exactly how he was. Like,
it's still how he is.
You'd have to see it. I mean, I remember when I first met Charles, I remember it as clear as day. It was in the Wentworth building, and which we used to call the cultural desert at Sydney Uni when we were there, because there was nothing happened. Everything happened in Manning.
It was where engineers went to get hot chips.
That's right, and swap flannies, and we did a theatre sports show in the evening over there.
Oh God!
And it was Adam Spencer was hosting, Rob Carlton was in a team and everything, and Charles was introduced to me by somebody, I can't remember who it was, and then I just started riffing, with Charles. And he ended up on the ground, on the floor of Wentworth, laughing and rolling around going, who is this woman? And I just was like, oh, I think we might be friends for a very long time.
That's
after
actually what happened when I got hired as well. Yeah, he just rolled on the ground, 42-year-old man. I'm guessing, I have no idea how old Charles is. He just had a birthday, didn't he? I literally wished you happy birthday.
It wasn't 42.
49? Am I close?
46.
That's
our average age.
That wasn't even worth it for the joke, really, was it?
What is the significance of swapping flannels?
I just made that up. Oh, okay. I really did. I've got to say, when I do the headlines, they are scripted. It is on the page and I read what's written in life and in my performance. I make it all up.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Chaser Report. News you can't trust.
You know what's really funny about the uni documentary as well is that the one, I think I said this when we did the whole segment on the podcast, but like the thing that I even escaped it feeling nostalgic for a time that I was barely alive for. And the thing is, I just think you couldn't do it now. Like you couldn't film a documentary that candidly because everyone now would see it as an opportunity to launch a career. Like reality TV is no longer just observing reality. It's like people can launch themselves off it. And so people would be filming the whole time or being somebody else. Whereas you guys, it just seemed like you were like in a room and cameras were there and you didn't really care.
I hate to say this, but I'm pretty confident Charles thought he was launching a career.
Well, Charles did, but that's Charles.
My favourite moment in the whole doco is when he goes, this is going to go national.
Oh, yeah, I have a clip of that somewhere.
Like just travelling around the country. He thought he was going to be the new, I don't know, there wasn't. That didn't happen back then, did it?
I remember in a share house I was living in, Charles came over one night and we drank a bottle of cask wine.
Nice.
As you do, goon bag. Mm-hmm. And we wrote like what we wanted to achieve in our lives. And number one on Charles's list was start a media empire.
Well,
I said to him, I still resent you to this day because I think my number one was become a national a national name or someone perform an act somewhere amazing. But I always remember Charles's was that. But I don't think you could film a documentary like uni now anymore because nobody is on campus like they were back then.
No, the life is not the same.
The life is not the same. I mean, the fact that the bars were open all day and all night and you could always go in and out and chat with people, and that's how you met people. I mean, the activities that everybody was doing back then, I don't think the student services are the same because everyone does it all from remotely and from home.
Yeah, and it's also like we have computers in our pockets. Yeah, like exactly. Our brains are constantly
We had lecture pads. That's what we had. And I'm left-handed and I had to always turn them upside down and back to front because my hand would hit the spiral.
Oh, my God. Yeah, like, and it made me a little sad for like, it's like that whole like, I was born in the wrong generation thing. But it just makes me go like,
I'm like that for the 1940s. I keep saying I was born like
generation.
Gene Kelly and I were destined to be together.
Yeah.
I'm sure of it.
It could still happen. We could hire a tap dancer here.
Can we get a seance going? Because I don't think I don't think he's available.
Yay! Oh, Ooky Spooky Chaser episode. Let's do it.
So the amazing thing, looking back though, Beck, as you say, so many people went into comedy and are still doing it today. And it's kind of bizarre, isn't it? Thinking back on all the decades, you just sort of kept pushing this stuff. When was the point where you knew improv was your thing? Because just as a footnote, we've discussed this on the podcast before, but Beck is a world champion of theatre sports. So
fuck yeah.
That just, I mean, very early on, I remember you were the legend of theatre sports even on campus.
Yes, and.
How did it all happen?
Yes, and. Well done. Shit joke. One of the rules.
Yeah.
It was interesting because I always wanted to be an actor. And so the reason I went to Sydney Uni was because of the SUDS, the Drama Society. And that was the first club or society that I joined in week, and that was my mission. And I auditioned for the major production of SUDS when I was a first year. And I got in, and it was like, oh my goodness, this is eye opening. This is extraordinary. Yeah. These amazing talents. And then I was one of only a few people from my school that went to Sydney Uni for a start, but I was one of the only, I was probably the only arts student. And so I didn't know anyone. I just turned up and was like, oh my God. And SUDS was a way for me to meet like-minded people and get creative. And then I heard this thing about this thing at lunchtime up in Manning Bar and at 1 o'clock on a Thursday, and I thought, oh, I'll go check it out. And I watched, and I stood there just watching it, and I was like, oh no, theatre sports, I remember, because I used to watch the show on the ABC that they filmed at Belvoir Street. Wow. Which was hosted by Paul Chubb and Sean McAuliffe played, Andrew Denton, like they were all in teams back then.
Wow.
And I thought, I'll just watch, I remember this. And so I watched it and I was like, oh, there's no way I could do that. Like I was just like, oh my God, they were amazing. And it was a nice way to kill an hour with other people, but you could be on your own.
Yeah.
And then I started going week after week, and eventually I started thinking of things to say in response to what somebody, some line that somebody would say on stage, and I'd come up with a reaction straight off.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, maybe it's not so sort of distant as I thought. And then a friend of mine, Dan Lloyd, he said to me, he was going back to do honours, I think, that year. And he said, oh, you can play theatre sports again. He was one of the stars. And he said, we should play.
Aww.
And I said, but I don't know. He was in the play I had done. I said, I don't know how to play. He goes, doesn't matter. And he literally dragged me on stage. I had no idea of the rules of I'd never done it before. And Adam Spencer would say, you're now doing play in the style of, and I'd turn to Dan and go, what's that? And he goes, we're doing it in the style of like a genre, like, Goldilocks and the Three Bears, like a Western Five.
Wow, so he's footnoting you during
as the setup.
So you have to improvise not only the scene, but how to improvise that sort of scene.
Exactly. And I was like, oh, and I was literally thrust on stage. Oh, and the first time I had done it, not so great. But then maybe the second or third.
Were you hooked though the first time?
I was. That's why I went back a second time. Mm. I wouldn't have done it had I not found something in it that was a bit exciting. And because I've been watching from afar, I knew. And then it was almost, and to this day when I improvise, because that's how I do my stand-up, it's how I do all my comedy, I'm still shocked when an audience laughs or reacts a certain way, because I'm going, what was funny about that? I'm so immersed in the character and everything, I don't realise it. And I just remember getting this response one lunchtime from the audience, and it was the equivalent of a stadium gig. I remember just going, oh my God, because when things went well at Manning Bar, you knew about it.
Oh, and it was so packed. I mean, it's hard to imagine nowadays, but it was hard to get a spot in the room.
People were sitting on the bins, like on the bins and everything. And it was, and people were, it was, but when things went poorly, you also knew about it. So it was a baptism of fire. I was like,
oh, there was heckling.
Know. Oh, there was oh.
so much heckling.
It reminded me that the only other time I felt that same moment was being in at Leighton Live in Edinburgh at the Edinburgh Fringe and seeing the audience throw their pint glasses at Russell Brand to get him off stage. I went, that's a bit Manning.
Yeah.
I just was just a little bit, you know, and I'm quite lovely and sentimental at the same time.
It's so funny because I feel like I don't really relate much to the upbringing because I don't think I've really gotten into comedy in a time where audiences are allowed. But I do feel like I played music gigs for like 6 years of my life and they were always fun. I always really enjoyed them, but I never really felt like I left them going, fuck, this is like just the best feeling ever. And my first comedy gig with an audience, I walked off stage just feeling like I'd just taken heroin. Like I literally was like, I want to kick a car. That was so fun. Like,
yeah, it's an extraordinary feeling. And you can understand like in stand-up in particular, you know, and everyone goes, oh my God, the Melbourne Comedy Festival, it must just be a month of, you know, the most amazing stuff. And you go, yeah, but it's also a month of people by most measures are quite insecure, are very needy, you
comedians.
Know,
wow, my God, you have to read me.
Desperate to be loved, you know what I mean? And so so you can see over the course of that 1 month of doing shows every night, you know, 6 nights a week,
yeah,
and then other gigs that you pick up along the way,
yeah,
you can just feel the warmth and the everybody's wrapping themselves in a blanket going, I need to get that fixed tomorrow. Yeah. You know, I need it. And we need it from each other, that thing as well. It's a very different, it's a very different drug to be
on. It's kind of, it feels a lot like a family, but like not like a weird MLM scheme, you're part of the family thing. It's more like a genuine, ever since I got into comedy, I just feel like, or maybe I just got insanely lucky, but I feel like a lot of the people I've interacted with in the comedy scene have just, it's like this pass down of information that you do.
Well, that's really great. And I'm glad that you said that because
seems rare to me.
I've got to say, I having sort of done improv as much as I did and toured and went all over the world with improv. Mm. And then I decided to get back into stand up. And it's a very solitary pursuit, which you know, improv normally isn't. And I went, ooh, you know, and just in the last couple of years, particularly I'll give you an anecdote. I was in a tour van driving to Albury Wodonga and all of the young people were in the van with me. And I just turned at one point and I said, you know what? I just realized I could have birthed all of you because I am that age where I could be all of their mum. Like that's who I am. And then I just turned at one point and I said, you know, and like Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon, I think I'm too old for this fucking shit. Because it does get to, it's a really interesting because in improv always you're supported because you need trust with those people you perform with. You need to trust them. You need to look into their eyes and kind of know where they're going.
Yeah.
Stand up, not a lot of eye contact
amongst
acts. Not a lot of because it's like,
interaction.
You know, interaction. And I'm not poo-pooing my mates in comedy at all. They know the ones I love and I know the ones I love. But it's interesting because I think things are changing for those coming up in the world of stand-up in particular.
Yeah.
Because back when I was doing it, you had to travel to the Manly Boat Shed, you had to do Oatley Hotel. Huh. And if you didn't do well in those gigs, well, it was unlikely you were going to get put on at the Comedy Store. Whereas comedy has changed now with technology. So you can put something out online and now people go, oh, my God, and suddenly the live gigs flow. Whereas we had to do all the live gigs and you had to really die.
Slog it.
Really, like, oh, my God, there's some gigs you die.
So that's fascinating. So because of YouTube and all that, you can actually start to find your niche. Because when every performer has a particular audience – and if you've got a particular niche or a weird or surreal comedy, for instance, is a great example of that. Like, I'm not big on surreal comedy, but a lot of people absolutely love the sort of Noel Fielding style thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can find those people on. It's beautiful because you have the filtration. Whereas I can just imagine someone like that going to play an RSL club and getting literal like bottles thrown at their head.
It's absolutely true. I've seen it time and time again because, and then at the Melbourne Comedy Festival, it's their fans that they've already established from their online presence that are coming to see their show and they're going to love everything they do. Whereas I've had to learn to adjust my material to, you know, regional towns, to, you know, pubs where there's three audience members and that you're just interrupting their schnitty and chips, you know, like there's a whole, and that for me, me has given me the versatility that I think I'm really happy that I had.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's, when I say generational gap, I still get along with young comedians like I do those my age, but there's a, it's almost like a nod and a wink of like, we've been in the trenches amongst those that are my age, you know, that have been around for a while. Like we were back in my day, we used to have to actually make people laugh, you know, that kind of stuff.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Chaser Report. News a few days after it happens.
I think it's also really interesting because, like, I mean, I think there is still a long ways to go for, like, women reception in comedy as well. But I feel like the shit that you and other female comics of your generation must have had to fucking put up with.
When I won the World Champs, the Improv World Champs at the Just for Last Festival, right?
Yeah.
I kept getting late and I got player of the tournament and I was the first woman to ever win that, right?
So you were.
Hell yeah. Got the trophy to prove it. You know, like Carl Reiner and I have the same trophy.
But anyway, God.
I'm just whatever. It's a standard trophy that everybody gets at Just for Laughs.
So it's a trophy.
You know, so I bet it's the trophy, right? And when I got that, it was really interesting that I was constantly being referred to when I came back home as the best female improviser.
Mm. What the fuck?
And it bugged me because it was like, no, I beat the men. Yeah. Like there was no gender in this. It was, I just happened to be a woman that won it. But that doesn't mean that I was in the category, the female category. Mm-hmm. I kicked the men's ass just as much as I kicked the women's ass, you know. And I found that incredibly frustrating. And when I first started improvising, somebody who'd been around for quite a while said to me, "You improvise like a man."
Oh, my God. Ooh. Like there's a gendered way to do it. What is a man offering to improvisation that a woman can't?
Well, what, do they get their dick out and flick it around everywhere?
Like, what do they do? The penis. Hang on, that's a legitimate art form.
Well, that's another story. Anyway, we've got heaps of stories. Anyway, I've got so many stories, but I'm going to keep to the point. But it's true. And I said, well, if that means that I am brave enough to come out and start a scene, if that means that I am brave enough to play any character, be it, I played an entire scene as a golf ball once on the stage at Belvoir Street Theatre.
Have you got a voice?
Oh, my God. I think I was a bit like that.
I love this.
Because I was little, but when I was hit, it was, wah! You know, that changed a bit. And so I've played everything. I love playing men on stage because it changes your whole physicality. Mm-hmm. You lead with your crotch.
Yes.
You take up more space. You sit with your legs open.
You talk a bit like this and you say, hello, how you going?
I know. And I said, well, if that's what you mean by playing like a man, that I'm being strong on stage, I'm starting scenes, I'm, you know, a presence that people, well, then so be it.
And P.S. fuck you.
And a P.S. fuck you.
That's so annoying. I feel like, I mean, I feel like it's changed a lot. Obviously, I will never know how you suffered. But even online, like I share some of my songs and stuff and I'm still developing as a comedian. I have no fucking idea what my niche is yet. I haven't really even done my show yet. But like the comments I get, at first it didn't bug me. It's then the sheer volume of getting things like, you're the female Bo Burnham, or the female Tim Minchin, the female Flight of the Conchords. And I'm like, a male musical comedian isn't getting you're the male Victoria version. Wood
That's
or
right.
like the male That's Jude right. Pearl. They're not getting
Because the men in comedy will always hold other men to the standards that they feel that they've set.
Yeah. Fucking
that
hell.
Sums up comedy for me.
Fuck.
Whereas women hold themselves up to the same standard that they've set themselves.
Yeah.
I reckon that's the big difference.
Can I ask about improv though, Beck? Because when you read bios of American comedy legends, people from SNL and all these sorts of things, you always hear that it's improv, it's Second City or it's Upright Citizens Brigade or whatever the thing is. Mm. Improv is this god kind of industry in the US, or certainly used to be. And, I mean, Steve Carell's character in The Office is always like, doing improv, we'll do a scene. But that doesn't exist here to the same degree. Now, admittedly, some of the people who we work with at Giant Dwarf, there's training and stuff for people who want to be improv, to do improv these days, but it's not anything like the scene in the US. And I wonder what you think about that as someone who's been part of this scene here, because I mean, in the States, at your level of ability, hell, you would have been on SNL, right?
Yeah. I totally agree. When we did The Worlds over in Canada, for me, it was the first time I'd improvised overseas. And the cues for our shows were around the block. They sold out every night and they were in a massive – we played in the round and it was for TV as well. So we had all these cameras and, you know, and the matches were 3 hours long and then they would edit it down to a TV version of an hour. And those people stood there around the block to watch us. And I had on my pass, my performer's pass, and it had a special thing on it and it said what I was part of, that I was part of the World Improv Cup. And people would look at that on my lanyard and be like, oh, my God. You're part of the improv, you know, like it was, we were lauded and I'd never experienced that before here. And I remember as I was teaching the contestants on Australia's Next Top Model to improvise, that I turned to a friend of mine, not realizing I was still mic'd, by the way. And I said, all my years of attempting to elevate improvisation to an art form and I've reduced it to this. Oh. That's what I said. But that was
it's kind of iconic.
And then when you were mic'd, you're like, it's a character, it's a bit.
It's a character.
Yes, and. I was
playing a bitchy improviser.
Acting is reacting to reactions.
But no, it was just because I did dedicate my entire early part of it trying to get people to appreciate it. And sadly, it was only when Whose Line Is It Anyway started happening here, like people started playing it on TV, that every time we do a show, they go, if you've seen Whose Line Is It Anyway, if you've seen, then that's what we do. And I'm like, why are we equating ourselves with a show that at that point was British-based and US-based and wasn't based here? But because it was a reference point that people could go, oh, it must be legit. Improv must be legit now because it's on TV. Yeah. But it's always been on TV. Years before I was doing it on Canadian TV. But it's – so I do, I've got really frustrated there for a while because I feel like I sort of dug the trenches and walked through them and now others are climbing over the top of me to – have the opportunities that we didn't have. And I think what a shame because we're almost 30 years late here when it comes to improv. And
it is weird because to me as an audience member, there is a special magic to improv. And it's because, you know, it's a unique journey that you're on, but the mood in the room, you don't get it with stand-up. I mean, people might love a stand-up gig, but it doesn't have the magic of – and to me, the what people will laugh at, if it was – if they didn't know it was improv, they'd feel differently about it. But – You want the performer to succeed and to win and it's like watching someone's brain unspool before you. It's just an amazing thing.
We at Theatre Sports Inc., we had a slogan that we used and it was by Carl Reiner. I just adore that man. And it said, a brilliant mind in panic is a wonderful thing to see. And that's what sums it up because you never know. This could fail within the blink of an eye. This scene could go. I remember playing the Cranston Cup Grand Final at the Enmore Theatre one year and we were the team to beat. We'd won all our heats. We'd won our semi. We were winning in the first half. We played one scene and it stunk. And we all three of us turned to the trophy and waved goodbye to it. And so we were everything was set up for us to win and just that one moment of something not connecting and not working and it was over. But
it's a tightrope, isn't it? That's what it is. It's the trapeze act.
And as I say, like when I teach improv, I always say, you know, you're standing on the edge of a cliff and those that want to play it safe will let their toes sort of hang over the edge and that's as far as I'll go. There might be some that might go onto their heels and you go, ooh, that's a bit more daring. But it's those that just take a running leap off the cliff and see what happens, that's the most exciting part. Figure it out when you're midair.
Yeah.
Like don't stand
like
on
Looney
the
Tunes.
Edge, you know. It's but yeah, but I did actually have a meeting once with a Hollywood agent. I will have to tell this story. So I went for this meeting. I flew to LA. I was on my way to perform at the Edinburgh Fringe to do an improvised Broadway musical.
Oh my God.
And I decided to go to the States on my own and just travel through the States and then go to London and then on to Edinburgh. Anyway, works out. I got this. It's such a random story. A quite well-known actor here in Australia saw me in a show and got in touch and thought I was great. And somehow he got me this meeting with a comedy agent, agent in LA.
Wow.
So I get there and I'm like preparing to go to this, you know, place. And I was so nervous. My showreel had been sent on and all that kind of stuff. And God. I sat there and then the assistant came and greeted me, who was clearly the one who'd seen my stuff. Right? Greets me and everything. And I go in and I sit on this big, there's this, the room is completely empty, but there's this L-shaped couch.
No.
And it's huge. It fills up like both walls of like, and I'm just like, then I just stood there going, where do I sit?
Like, is the corner too presumptuous?
Is the middle being a bit fresh? Like, where do I sit on this couch? So I was, if there was a camera watching me, I would have just been going, balking at all my choices of which cushion to sit on.
That's part of the test.
Part of the test. And then I sat down and I waited and I waited and I waited. Oh, and in walks this comedy manager holding a bowl of dry cereal.
Mood.
And just comes in eating these dry cereal, right? Oh, and sits opposite me and says, want some? I'm like, oh, no, thank you. Thinking, it took me 20 minutes to figure out where to sit. Now you want me to eat dry cereal? Like, what is this? This is like, and then I kept looking for the hidden cameras because I was convinced I had been in an elaborate setup like for Canon camera or something like that because this friend had organized this thing. And now suddenly I've got this, where do I sit on this couch? I've got this guy eating dry cereal. He then gets up and leaves me again. So I'm sitting there on my own. Nothing has happened right. Half an hour into this meeting. Then he sits down and he says to me, okay, so you and all your characters that you play are on a boat. The boat is sinking. Which character do you save and why? Was his opening question.
Are you fucking serious?
And I said, well, sorry.
Is this the same guy with the cereal?
Yeah, same cereal guy, right? Because he comes back in and then sits down and then he proceeds with this question.
I mean, we all know the answer. It's obviously the golf ball.
Well, yeah, well, clearly. If only he could see my golf ball.
I've got a trajectory.
Well, I said to him, well, I think I'd probably save myself. I said, because let's face it, without me, they're nothing.
Amazing answer. Amazing answer.
Stone cold, shoved a bit of cereal in his mouth.
This is my nightmare.
And he's like, I could get you on SNL. I could get you on SNL. And I'm like going, well, you may be in my head. I'm like, you probably should watch my show real first before promising this. It was the most bizarre experience. And then to make it even more bizarre, I was picked up by a friend of mine afterwards to just go and hang out. And he's in Reno 911. And he was the voice of Rocco in Rocco's Modern Life and stuff, right? Carlos Salazarki. And he picks me up and I'm like, that was the most demoralizing experience of my life. And he goes, hey, welcome to LA.
It's just such like a water weird of a place. Duck's back.
Anyway, bizarre. That was my, and then I kept waiting for Lorne Michaels to call me, but clearly it never happened.
He hadn't watched uni. That's not,
well, if only I'd eaten the cereal. I kept thinking maybe that was the key.
Was he trying to drug you?
I have no idea. It was the most bizarre day of my life.
Yeah. What time of day was it for the cereal? Was it like an afternoon cereal?
No, we're talking like 11 a.m.
That's a weird 11:30. Time for dry cereal. Yeah. I mean, I eat night cereal because I'm a little gremlin. But I have milk with it. I'm not a fucking criminal.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
The Chaser Report. Now with extra whispers.
I know, so I've got so many battle stories. I've got so many almost stories where I could have been, you know. And I just feel, we respected improv here half as much as they do over in North America. Different story.
You're a fucking champion.
I'm going to cry now.
We should do a double act.
We should.
You could teach me improv.
And it's so good to see so many young women coming up in through the comedy ranks, and I say this all the time, and I say it about improvisers too, but whenever I would see a really strong woman improvising, I'd always go, let's play together. Mm. You know, like, let's just, because I feel like it's a responsibility of people now my age who've been given opportunities and have learnt so much. You've got to encourage the next generation.
Well, nobody brings the house down like Beck doing a musical number that's completely improvised in a genre. So you should give it a go.
Hey,
you heard it here first.
Hey. We should.
Yeah, I'm all about the makeup.
I love playing on the go too. So, like,
there you go. See?
I think it's time to take this one offline.
I know. Well, I know. I remember I mentioned Spontaneous Broadway. That was one of my performing, like, thrills doing that season. You know, working with Genevieve Morris, you know, Jeff Payne, Julia Zemiro, like, all doing this show where we improvise Broadway musicals and pitch Broadway musical ideas is just, it's heaven. So I'm all about it.
Absolutely. All right. I will keep that in mind. I love doing shit like that. Yeah. I love playing piano on the, like, I've done one improv piano gig and it's so aggressive in the moment because then somebody's like, a tango! And you're like, what the dump? But then you just kind of do it. It's so freeing.
And that's the thing, you commit. And that's what you have to do in improv.
Are we committing? Are you both committing?
What, right now?
I
haven't got my keyboard.
I'm getting committed.
Not on the podcast. I'm saying you're committing to doing a gig.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
All right.
Fucking, yeah.
We'll publicize it through the podcast and we'll all right. We'll all fucking turn up.
Well, nobody's given me one since we started back after
lockdown. Well, listen, I need to write like one more song for my show. I could just avoid it altogether and get you to come and do my show with
me.
There
you go.
You don't need to prepare. You just need to be improv.
Yes, you've got to prepare. As I say with improv, you've got to prepare to be unprepared.
Perfect. That's how I walk into this office every single day.
Beck, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure. Lovely to chat. Can we do a part two?
Absolutely.
Three?
I suspect we will.
Fuck yeah.
I could keep going for hours. Can you tell I live alone? No.
What a note to leave it on. Our Gears from Road microphones were part of the Acast Creator Network. We will have. You do. You have us.
Move in here. We live here.
We'll catch you next time, Beck.
Bye.